Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, and here is part two of Gone Fishing by James Schmitz.
McAllen looked at him. Are you thinking of financing the experiments, Mr. Chard? In return, Barney said, for a consideration. What's that? McAllen's expression grew wary. When you retired, Barney told him, I dropped a nice piece of money as a consequence. It was the first beating I'd taken, and it hurt. I'd like to pick that money up again. All right. We're agreed it can't be done on the McAllen tube. The tube wouldn't help make the world a safer place for Barney Chard. But the tube isn't any more remarkable than the mind that created it. Now, I know a company which could be top of the heap in electronics precision work. One-shot specialties is what they go in for. If it had your mind as technical advisor, I can buy a controlling interest in that company tomorrow, Doctor, and you can have the $1.5 million paid off in not much more time than you expect to take to get your monster back under control and shut down. 3 years of your technical assistance, and we're clear. McAllen's face reddened slowly. I've considered hiring out, of course, he said, many times. I need the money very badly. But aren't you overlooking something? What? I went to considerable pains, said McAllen, to establish myself as a lunatic. It was distasteful, but it seemed necessary to discourage anyone from making too close an investigation of some of my more recent lines of research. If it became known now that I was again in charge of a responsible project. Barney shook his head. No problem, Doctor. We'd be drawing on outside talent for help in specific matters. Very easy to cover up any leads to you, personally. I've handled that general sort of thing before. McAllen frowned thoughtfully. I see, but I'd have... There wouldn't be so much work that... No, Barney said. I guarantee you'll have all the time you want for your own problem. He smiled, considering what you told me. I'd like to hear that one's been solved myself. McAllen grinned briefly. I can imagine. Very well. When can you let me have the money, Mr. Chard? The sun was setting beyond the little lake as Barney drew the shades over the cabin window again. Dr. McAllen was half inside the built-in closet at the moment, fitting a pair of toggle switches to the concealed return device in there. Here we go, he said suddenly. 3 feet from the wall of the room, the shadowy suggestion of another wall and of an open door became visible. Barney said dubiously, We came out of that. McAllen looked at him sad. The appearance is different on the exit side, but the tube's open now. Here, I'll show you. He went up to the apparition of a door, abruptly seemed to melt into it. Barney held his breath and followed. Again, there was no sensory reaction to passing through the tube. As his foot came down on something solid and the shadowiness into which he stepped, the living room in Sweetwater Beach sprang into sudden existence about him. Seems a little odd from that end, first time through, doesn't it? McAllen remarked. Barney let out his breath. If I'd been the one who'd invented the tube, he said honestly, I'd never have had the nerve to try it. McAllen grinned. I tell you the truth, I did need a drink or two the first time, but it's dead safe if you know just what you're doing. Which was not, Barney felt, too reassuring. He looked back. The door through which they had come was the one by which they had left. But beyond it now lay a section of the entrance hall of the Sweetwater Beach House. Don't let that fool you, said McAllen, following his gaze. If you tried to go out into the hall at the moment, you'd find yourself right back in the cabin. Light rays passing through the tube can be shunted off and on. He went over to the door, closed and locked it, dropping the key in his pocket. I keep it locked. I don't often have visitors, but if I had one while the door was open, it could be embarrassing. What about the other end? Barney asked. The door appeared in the cabin when you turn those switches. What happens now? Suppose someone breaks into the cabin and starts prowling around. Is the door still there? McAllen shook his head. Not unless that someone happened to break in within the next half minute, he considered. Let's put it this way. The tube's permanently centered on its two exit points. But the effect ordinarily is dissipated over half a mile of the neighborhood at the other end. For practical purposes, there is no useful effect. When I'm going to go through, I bring the exit end down to the focus point. Does that make sense? Very well. It remains focused for around 60 or 90 seconds, depending on how I set it. Then it expands again. He nodded at the locked door. In the cabin, that's disappeared by now. Walk through the space where it's been, and you'll notice nothing unusual. Clear? Barney hesitated. And if that door were still open here, and somebody attempted to step through after the exit end had expanded? Well, McAllen said, moving over to a wall buzzer and pressing it, that's what I meant when I said it could be embarrassing. He'd get expanded, too. Disastrously. Could you use a drink, Mr. Chard? I know I want one. The drinks, served by Fredericks, were based on a rather rough grade of bourbon, but Barney welcomed them. There was almost a sick fascination in what was a certainty now. He was going to get the tube. That tremendous device was his for the taking. He was well inside McAllen's guard. Only carelessness could arouse the old man's suspicions again. And Barney was not going to be careless. No need to hurry anything. He would play the reserved role he had selected for himself, leave developments up to the fact that McAllen had carried the burden of his secret for 12 years with no more satisfactory confidant than Fredericks to trust with it. Having told Barney so much, McAllen wanted to tell more. He would have needed very little encouragement to go on talking about it now. Barney offered no encouragement. Instead, he gave McAllen a cautiously worded reminder that it was not inconceivable they had an audience here, at which McAllen reluctantly subsided. There was, however, one fairly important question Barney still wanted answered today. The nature of the answer would tell him the manner in which McAllen should now be handled. He waited until he was on his feet and ready to leave before presenting it. McAllen's plump cheeks were flushed from the two highballs he'd put away. In somewhat awkward phrases, he had been expressing his gratitude for Barney's generous help and his relief that because of it, the work on the tube could now be brought to an end. "Just one thing about that still bothers me a little, Doctor," Barney said candidly. McAllen looked concerned. "What's that, Mr. Chard?" "Well, you're in good health, I'd say," Barney smiled. "But suppose something did happen to you before you succeeded in shutting the McAllen tube down." He inclined his head toward the locked door. "That thing would still be around waiting for somebody to open it and step through." McAllen's expression of concern vanished. He dug a forefinger cheerfully into Barney's ribs. "Young man, you needn't worry. I've been aware of the possibility, of course. And believe me, I'm keeping very careful notes and instructions. Safe deposit boxes. I'll talk about that tomorrow, eh? Somewhere else. Had a man in mind, as a matter of fact. But we can make better arrangements now. You see, it's really so ridiculously easy at this stage." Barney cleared his throat. "Some other physicist?" "Any capable physicist," McAllen said decidedly. "Just a matter, you see, of how reliable he is." He winked at Barney. Talk about that tomorrow, too, or one of these days. Barney stood looking down with a kind of detached surprise at a man who had just pronounced sentence of death casually on himself and on an old friend. For the first time in Barney's career, the question of deliberate murder had not only entered an operation, but had become in an instant an unavoidable part of it. Frank Elby, ambitious and money-hungry, could take over where McAllen left off. Elby was highly capable, and Elby could be controlled. McAllen could not. He could only be tricked and, if necessary, killed. It was necessary, of course, if McAllen lived until he knew how to shut the tube down safely. He simply would shut it down and destroy the device and his notes on it. A man who had gone to such extreme lengths to safeguard the secret was not going to be talked out of his conviction that the McAllen tube was a menace to the world. Fredericks, the morose eavesdropper, had to be silenced with his employer to assure Barney of his undisputed possession of the tube. Could he still let the thing go? Let McAllen live? He couldn't, Barney decided. He'd dealt himself a hand in a new game, and a big one, a fantastic, staggering game when one considered the possibilities in the tube. It meant new interest. It meant life for him. It wasn't in his nature to pull out. The part about McAllen was cold necessity. A very ugly necessity, but McAllen, pleasantly burbling of something as they walked down the short hall to the front door, already seemed a little unreal. A roly-poly, muttering, fading, small ghost. In the doorway, Barney exchanged a few words. He couldn't have repeated them an instant later. With the ghost became briefly aware of a remarkably firm handclasp and started down the cement walk to the street. Evening had come to California at last. A few houses across the street made dim silhouettes against the hills, some of the windows lit. He felt, Barney realized, curiously tired and depressed. A few steps behind him, he heard McAllen quietly closing the door to his home. The walk, the garden, the street, the houses and hills beyond vanished in a soundlessly violent explosion of white light around Barney Chard. His eyes might have been open for several seconds before he became entirely aware of the fact. He was on his back, looking up at the low raftered ceiling of a room. The light was artificial, subdued. It gave the impression of nighttime outdoors. Memory suddenly blazed up. Tricked, came the first thought. Outsmarted, outfoxed, and by. Then that went lost in a brief, intense burst of relief at the realization he was still alive and apparently unhurt. Barney turned sharply over on his side. Bed underneath, he discovered, and stared around. The room was low, wide. Something undefinably odd. He catalogued it quickly. Redwood walls, Navajo rugs on the floor, bookcases, unlit fireplace, chairs, table, desk with a typewriter and a reading lamp. Across the room, a tall, dark grandfather clock with a bright metal disc instead of a clock face stood against the wall. From it came a soft, low thudding, as deliberate as the heartbeat of some big animal. It was the twin of one of the clocks he had seen in McAllen's living room. The room was McAllen's, of course, almost luxurious by comparison with his home, but wholly typical of the man. And now Barney became aware of its unusual feature. There were no windows. There was only one door. So far to his right he had to twist his head around to see it. It stood half open. Beyond it lay a few feet of a narrow passage, within his range of vision, lighted in the same soft manner as the room. No sound came from there. Had he been left alone? And what had happened? He wasn't in McAllen's home or in that fishing shack at the lake. The tube might have picked him up somehow in front of McAllen's house and transported him to the Majorca place. Or he might be in a locked hideaway McAllen had built beneath the Sweetwater beach house. Two things were unpleasantly obvious. His investigations hadn't revealed all of McAllen's secrets. And the old man hadn't really been fooled by Barney Chard's smooth approach. Not, at any rate, to the extent of deciding to trust him. Hot chagrin at the manner in which McAllen had handed the role of dupe back to him flooded Barney for a moment. He swung his legs over the side of the bed and stood up. His coat had been hung neatly over the back of a chair a few feet away. His shoes stood next to the bed. Otherwise, he was fully clothed. Nothing in the pockets of the coat appeared to have been touched. Billfold, cigarette case, lighter, even the gun were in place. The gun, almost startlingly, was still loaded. Barney thrust the revolver, thoughtfully, into his trousers pocket. His wristwatch seemed to be the only item missing. He glanced about the room again, then at the half-open door and the stretch of narrow hallway beyond. McAllen must have noticed the gun. The fact that he hadn't bothered to take it away, or at least to unload it, might have been reassuring under different circumstances. Here it could have a very disagreeable meaning. Barney went quietly to the door, stood listening a few seconds, became convinced there was no one within hearing range, and moved on down the hall. In less than 2 minutes, he returned to the room with the first slow welling of panic inside him. He had found a bathroom, a small kitchen and pantry, a storage room twice as wide and long as the rest of the place combined, crammed with packaged and crated articles and with an attached freezer. If it was mainly stored food, as Barney thought, and if there was adequate ventilation and independent power, as seemed to be the case, then McAllen had constructed a superbly self-sufficient hideout. A man might live comfortably enough for years without emerging from it. There was only one thing wrong with the setup from Barney's point of view, the thing he'd been afraid of. Nowhere was there an indication of a window or of an exit door. The McAllen tube, of course, might make such ordinary conveniences unnecessary. And if the tube was the only way in or out, then McAllen incidentally had provided himself with an escape-proof jail for anyone he preferred to keep confined. The place might very well have been built several hundred feet underground. A rather expensive proposition, but aside from that, quite feasible. Barney felt his breath begin to quicken, and he told himself to relax. Wherever he was, he shouldn't be here long. McAllen presently would be getting in contact with him, and then... His glance touched the desk across the room, and now he noticed his missing wristwatch on it. He went over, picked it up, and discovered that the long white envelope on which the watch had been placed was addressed to him. For a moment he stared at the envelope, then his finger shaking a little, he tore the envelope open and pulled out the typewritten sheets within. The letterhead he saw without surprise was Oliver B. McAllen, the letter read. Dear Mr. Chard, an unfortunate series of circumstances combined with certain character traits in yourself made it necessary to inconvenience you in a rather serious manner. To explain, the information I gave you regarding the McAllen tube and my own position was not entirely correct. It is not the intractable instrument I presented it as being. It can be shut off again quite readily and without any attendant difficulties. Further, the decision to conceal its existence was not reached by myself alone. For years we... That is, Mr. Fredericks, who holds a degree in engineering and was largely responsible for the actual construction of the tube, and I have been members of an association of which I cannot tell you too much, but I may say that it acts, among other things, as the present custodian of some of the more dangerous products of human science, and will continue to do so until a more stable period permits their safe release. To keep developments such as the McAllen tube out of irresponsible hands is no easy task these days, but a variety of effective devices are employed to that end. In this instance, you happened upon a rigged situation which had been designed to draw action from another man, an intelligent and unscrupulous individual, who lately had indicated a disturbing interest in events connected with a semi-public fiasco of my matter transmitter some years ago. The chances of another person becoming aware of the temporal incongruities which were being brought to this man's attention were regarded as so remote that they need be given no practical consideration. Nevertheless, the unexpected happened. You became interested. The promptness with which you acted on your chance observation shows a bold and imaginative manner of thinking, on which you may be genuinely congratulated. However, perhaps a less commendable motivation was also indicated. While I appeared to stall on coming to decisions you may have regarded as inevitable, your background was being investigated by the association. The investigation confirmed that you fall within a personality category of which we have the greatest reason to be wary. Considering the extent of what you had surmised and learned, falsified though the picture was, this presented a serious problem. It was made more acute by the fact that the association is embarking on a 5-year plan of some importance. Publicity during this period would be more than ordinarily undesirable. It will, therefore, be necessary to see to it that you have no opportunity to tell what you know before the plan is concluded. I am sure you can see it would be most unwise to accept your simple word on the matter. Your freedom of movement and of communication must remain drastically restricted until this 5-year period is over. Within the next 2 weeks, as shown by the clock in your quarters, it will have become impossible for me or for any member of the association to contact you again before the day of your release. I tell you this so that you will not nourish vain hopes of changing the situation in your favor, but will adjust as rapidly as you can to the fact that you must spend the next 5 years by yourself. What ameliorations of this basic condition appeared possible have been provided. It is likely that you will already have tried to find a way out of the cabin in which you were left. The manner of doing this will become apparent to you exactly 24 hours after I conclude and seal this letter. It seemed best to advise you of some details of your confinement before letting you discover that you have been given as much limited freedom as circumstances allowed. Sincerely yours, Oliver B. McAllen. Barney dropped the letter on the desk, stared down at it, his mouth open. His face had flushed red. "Why, he's crazy," he said aloud at last. "He's crazier than..." He straightened, looked uneasily about the room again. Whether a maniac McAllen made a more desirable jailer than a secret association engaged in keeping dangerous scientific developments under cover could be considered an open question. The most hopeful thought was that Dr. McAllen was indulging an unsuspected and nasty sense of humor. Unfortunately, there wasn't the slightest reason to believe it. McAllen was wise to him. The situation was no gag, and neither was it necessarily what McAllen wanted him to think. Unless his watch had been reset, he had been knocked out by whatever hit him for roughly 5 hours. Or 17, he amended. But he would have been hungry if it'd been the longer period, and he wasn't. 5 hours, then. 5 hours wouldn't have given them time to prepare the cabin as it was prepared for someone's indefinite stay. At a guess, McAllen had constructed it as a secure personal retreat in the event of something like a nuclear holocaust. But in that case, why vacate it now for Barney Chard? Too many questions, he thought. Better just keep looking around. The blank metal face on the grandfather clock swung back to reveal a group of four dials, each graduated in a different manner, only one of them immediately familiar. Barney studied the other three for some seconds. Their meaning suddenly became clear. The big clock had just finished, softly talking away the fourth hour of the first day of the first month of year one. There were five figures on the year dial. He stared at it. A five-year period of something seemed to be the key to the entire setup. Barney shook his head. Key it might be, but not one he could read without additional data. He snapped the cover disc shut on the unpleasantly suggestive dials and began to go mentally over McAllen's letter. The business that in 24 hours, 20 now, the manner of leaving the cabin would become apparent to him, that seemed to dispose of the possibility of being buried underground here. McAllen would hardly have provided him with a personal model of the tube. He must be speaking of an ordinary door opening on the immediate environment equipped with a time lock. In that case, where was the door? Barney made a second, far more careful search. 3 hours later, he concluded it. He'd still found no trace of an exit, but the paneling in any of the rooms might slide aside to reveal one at the indicated time, or a section of the floor might swing back above a trap door. There was no point in attempting to press the search any further. After all, he only had to wait. On the side, he'd made other discoveries. After opening a number of crates in the storage room and checking the contents of the freezer, he could assume that there was, in fact, more than enough food here to sustain one man for 5 years. Assuming the water supply held out, there was no way of checking on it. The source of the water, like that of the power and the ventilation, lay outside the area which was accessible to him. But if the water could be depended on, he wouldn't go hungry or thirsty. Even tobacco and liquor were present in comparably liberal quantities. The liquor he'd seen was all good. Almost at random, he had selected a bottle of cognac and brought it and a glass to the main room with him. The thought of food wasn't attractive at the moment, but he could use a drink. He half filled the glass, emptied it with a few swallows, refilled it, and took it over to one of the armchairs. He began to feel more relaxed almost at once. But the truth was, he acknowledged, settling back in the chair, that the situation was threatening to unnerve him completely. Everything he'd seen implied McAllen's letter came close to stating the facts. What wasn't said became more alarming by a suggestion of deliberate vagueness. Until that melodramatically camouflaged door was disclosed, 17 hours from now, he'd be better off if he didn't try to ponder the thing out. And the best way to do that might be to take a solid load on rapidly and then sleep away as much of the intervening time as possible. He wasn't ordinarily a hard drinker, but he'd started on the second bottle before the cabin began to blur on him. Afterwards, he didn't remember making it over to the bed. Barney woke up ravenous and without a trace of hangover. Making a mental adjustment to his surroundings took no more time than opening his eyes. He'd been dreaming Dr. McAllen had dropped him into a snake pit and was sadistically dangling a rope 12 feet above his head, inviting him to climb out. To find himself still in the softly lit cabin was, for a few seconds at any rate, a relief. The relief faded as he sat up and looked at his watch. Still over an hour to go before McAllen's idiotic door became apparent, Barney swore and headed for the bathroom to freshen up. There was an electric shaver there, the end of its cord vanishing into the wall. Barney used it as meticulously as if he were embarking on a day of normal activities. Prepared a breakfast in the kitchen and took it to the main room. He ate unhurriedly, absorbing in his thoughts, now and then glancing about the room. After a few minutes, he uneasily pushed back the plate and stood up. If McAllen's 24 hours began with the movement the big clock in the room had been started, the door should be in evidence by now. Another tour of the place revealed nothing and left him nervous enough to start biting his nails. He moved about the room, looked over things he'd already investigated. A music cabinet, he thought it was a radio at first, but it was only an elaborate hi-fi record player. Two enclosed racks of records went with it, mainly classical stuff apparently, and a narrow built-in closet with three polished fishing rods and related gear, which would have allowed for speculation on the nature of the cabin's surroundings, except that McAllen might feel compelled to have a sampling of his toys around him wherever he was. Barney closed the closet door morosely, stood regarding the two crowded bookcases next to it, plenty of books, reflecting the McAllen taste again, technical tomes, great literature, Dickens, Melville, The Life of Gandhi. Barney grunted and was turning away, when another title caught his eye. He glanced back at it and hauled out the book. Freshwater Game Fish Tested Methods of Their Pursuit. The author, O.B. McAllen. Barney was opening the book when the cabin's door also opened. Bright light, daylight, filled the room with so sudden a gush that Barney's breath caught in his throat. The book seemed to leap out of his hands. With the same glance, he saw that the low, wide picture window, which abruptly had appeared in the opposite wall, occupying almost half its space, and in the other wall on the far left a big door which was still swinging slowly open into the room. Daylight poured in through the window and door, and beyond them, for seconds, he stared at the scene outside, barely aware of what he was looking at, while his mind raced on. He had searched every inch of the walls, and those thick wooden panels hadn't simply slid aside. The surfaces of the door frame and window were flush with the adjoining wall sections. So the McAllen tube was involved in these changes, he might have guessed. Barney thought that McAllen would have found more than one manner of putting the space-twisting properties of his device to use. And then finally, he realized what he was seeing through the window and beyond the door. He walked slowly up to the window, still breathing unevenly. The scene was unfamiliar, but not at all extraordinary. The cabin appeared to be partway up one side of a heavily forested, rather narrow valley. It couldn't be more than half a mile to the valley's far slope, which rose very steeply, almost like a great cresting green wave, filling the entire window. Coming closer, Barney saw the skyline above it, hazy, summery, brilliantly luminous. This cabin of McAllen's might be in one of the wilder sections of the Canadian Rockies. Or, and this was a considerably less happy thought, it probably could have been set up just as well in some area like the Himalayas. But a more immediate question was whether the cabin actually was in the valley, or only appearing to be there. The use of the tube made it possible that this room and its seeming surroundings were very far apart, in fact. And just what would happen to him then if he decided to step outside? There were scattered sounds beyond the open door, bird chirpings and whistles, and the continuous burring calls of what Barney decided would be a wild pigeon. Then a swirl of wind stirred the nearer branches. He could feel the wash of the breeze in the room. It looked and sounded and felt all right. Barney scowled undecidedly, clearing his throat, then discovered that a third item had appeared in the room along with the door and the window. In the wall, just this side of the door, at the shoulder height, was a small ivory plate with two black switches on it, presumably the controls for door and window. Barney went over, gingerly touched the one on the right, watching the window, then flicked up the switch. Instantly, the window had vanished. The wood paneling again covered the wall. Barney turned the switch down. The window was back. The door refused to disappear until he pushed it shut, and then it obeyed its switch with the same promptness. He went back across the room, returned with one of McAllen's fishing poles, and edged its tip tentatively out through the door. He wouldn't have been surprised if the tip had disintegrated in that instant. But nothing at all occurred. He dug about with the pole and the loose earth beyond the doorsill, then drew it back. The breeze was flowing freely past him, and a few grains of soil blew over the sill and into the room. The door seemed to be concealing no grisly tricks and looked to be safe enough. Barney stepped out on the sill, moved a few hesitant steps, stood looking about. He had a better view of the valley here. And the better view told him immediately that he was not in the Canadian Rockies. At least Canada, to his knowledge, had no desert. And on the left, this valley came to an end, perhaps a little more than a mile away from the cabin, its wooded slopes flowing steeply down to a landscape which was dull rust red, flat sand with stretches alternating with worn rock escarpments, until the desert's rim rose toward and touched the hazy white sky. Not so very different from... Barney's eyes widened suddenly. Could he be in the Sierras, perhaps not more than 3 or 4 hours' drive from Los Angeles? 3 or 4 hours' drive if he'd had a car, of course, but even so. He stared around, puzzled. There were no signs of a human being, of human habitation. Somebody else must be here. Somebody had to keep guard on him. Otherwise, there was nothing to stop him from walking away from this place. Though it might very well be a long, uncomfortable hike to any civilized spot. Even if this did turn out to be the Himalayas or some equally remote area, there must be hill tribes about if one went far enough. There should even be an occasional airplane passing overhead. Barney stood just outside the door, frowning, pondering the situation again, searching for the catch in it. McAllen and his friends, whatever else they might be, weren't stupid. There was something involved here that he hadn't become aware of yet. Almost without thought, then, he turned up his head, squinting at the bright, hazy sky above him, and saw it. His breath sucked in and burst from his lungs in a half-strangled, terrified squawk as he staggered back into the cab and slammed the door shut, then spun around and began slapping frantically at the switches on the wall plate until the door and window were gone and only the cabin's soft illumination was around him again. Then he crouched on the floor, his back against the wall, shaking with a terror he could hardly have imagined before. He knew what the catch was now. He had understood it completely in the instant of glancing up and seeing that the tiny, brilliant, blue-white point of light glaring down at him through the incandescent cloud layers above, like a blazing, incredibly horrible insect eye, was this world's sun.
Return next week for the final part of Gone Fishing on Amazing Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies.